It's been a few evenings. We're going to talk about why. But for now, welcome to The Watcher. I'm Connor, and this is Fenn.
Hello, everybody.
Fenn, a couple of things. One, what are we going to talk about? And two, what's my problem? Why have I been so reluctant to even talk about it at all?
Well, there has been turmoil in the U.S. political system around the release of the Mueller report, and there are a lot of high expectations about that. I think there's a lot of malaise maybe on the left too, that things aren't working as fast as they'd like. And I think that matters too. I think we talked the last time about how slow the political system is designed to move. And I think that's part of it. And I wanted to talk about that too.
All right. Yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. There has been a lot of malaise. You kind of caught me in the middle of thinking about it when you asked me the question, because there has. You look out in the social media sphere, I guess you could say, you see that there's a lot of interesting comments going about. And I think a lot of that is this frustration that there was an election in November and people wanted things to happen and they're not happening as fast as they'd like. And there was a lot of expectation on this Mueller report coming out that, you know, crimes would be revealed. And that's not really how it's working out. And I wanted to get into detail a little bit about that and a little bit about why the process is working and a little bit about the continuing collapse of the Republican Party, actually.
Okay. Speaking for myself, I can do with hearing this.
Okay. Well, me too, actually. It is. I've had some life events as well that have brought me into a harder place. And it's nice to be able to look at kind of step away and take a bigger picture look of what's going on in politics today to see that there is hope on the horizon, politically speaking.
Yeah.
So we'll start with the Mueller report, which I'm starting to refer to as the Barr report. I'm sure everyone knows that, right? Well, I mean, I'm sure everyone knows that the administration tried to grab the narrative almost immediately by saying that there was no evidence of obstruction of justice and something along the lines of it wasn't proven that there was collusion between individuals in the Trump campaign and the Russian government or Russian act. I think actually it specifically said the Russian government, which was the mandate of the investigation. So that question needed to be answered more than anything. The obstruction question needed to be answered because it developed over the time of the investigation. First off, there's a lot of consternation because it wasn't immediately made public because of this four-page letter that, you know, with what I think it was 57 words or 47 words or something from the actual report. And there was a lot of there's a lot of frustration that this report has not been made public yet. I'm reserving judgment on this report until it is actually made public. And I have a high, high, high confidence level that it will be made public by hook or by crook.
Right.
Well, there's basically no way that the administration can stop the Gang of Eight, per se. Do you know the Gang of Eight is in Congress?
No.
The Gang of Eight in Congress is the congressional leaders. That would be the majority and minority leaders of the two chambers, and then the Intel Committee and Defense Committee chairs, and then the Speaker of the House.
Okay.
Right? And they see everything. Like, there's nothing the administration has that the Gang of Eight does not have access to.
Okay.
They have the highest security clearance available in the land, and the administration can't take it. Well, I'm pretty sure the administration can't take it away, although that might be brought into question given this current administration. So don't take that as a you know, the gospel, I guess.
Right.
But there is no way that it will be. I mean, they could legally challenge the administration could legally challenge them trying the Gang of Eight trying to see this, but I really don't see that passing through court. It's real well established in the legal system that these people have the right to see pretty much any government document that exists.
Okay.
So, and I think these people will see it. And these people do have staff members And I think that the House Intel Committee, they have a legitimate right to see it, as does the House Judiciary Committee, given their jurisdiction over the Department of Justice. So there are entities inside the House with Democratic control that have the legal right to see this report in its entirety, except for the grand jury testimonies, which they can petition the court to give to them anyway.
Okay.
Fair enough?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that's not public, right?
Right.
It's not. I mean, they'll do it in one of their I can't believe I just forgot it. One of their secure access, whatever, like SCAT. It's not SCAT.
Yeah.
Whatever they call those things, the secure access rooms they have. But these people have staff members. Like there was something Franklin Delano Roosevelt said ages ago. Of course, he said nothing happens in politics without a reason, and that's the truth. And we see that illustrated with really, really well with the way Devin Nunes acted during the beginning of the Trump administration. Every single leak that came out of that committee came out of that committee because a Republican wanted it to be leaked.
Right.
So nothing was happening without a reason that wasn't apparent to us who were receiving the information.
Okay. Yeah.
So there's always something going on behind the scenes in politics. Always. Good or bad. There is always something going on behind the scenes in politics. These are people with power. And to maintain power, you can't let everybody know your secrets. You can't let everybody know everything you're doing.
Yeah.
Fair?
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes – that part at least is intuitive.
So it would be the same way if the chairs of these committees got this report, or if the Gang of Eight got this report. These people have staff people who know reporters. Right?
Yeah.
So it will be public. Maybe not all at once, but it will be public. Whatever's most politically advantageous to the people who are seeing the report, they'll find a way to get something out that helps their narrative.
Okay.
And if one side starts, the other side will follow suit. One of the reasons that the Department of Justice and the CIA and the FBI, that is the Department of Justice, but one of the reasons the intelligence community and the Department of Justice don't like to share information with Congress is that Congress leaks. That is not something new to our times. That is the way people in power behave. Information is power, and they readily utilize it to continue their narrative to hold their own power. Fair?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if it does get to Congress, which I can't see any reason that it won't, it will eventually become public by hook or by crook because Congress leaks.
Okay. And that is at this point, that's just axiomatic. That's just accepted.
Yeah. That's just me assessing the history of of the American political system.
Yeah.
And if it were to hold true. Yeah, that's probably what will happen. If it doesn't get – Barr did testify today that he would release a color-coded, explained why anything was redacted, release of the report. I think he said by next week, but he said he was going to release it this week. So, I don't really trust Barr anyway. He let Iran-Contra guys off. So, just another in a long line of Republican hacks that doesn't really care about the legal system unless it's to their advantage.
And, I mean, his purpose was stated.
Beforehand. Yeah, it really was. It really was. Now, there are a couple of other conceptual reasons about the report itself and the American justice system, or what our concept of it is, that also lead me with encouraging thoughts about the Mueller report in its content. And I wouldn't mind just a few minutes on that too.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. I think, you know how you and I have talked about how the presidency, the running for the presidency has become like a personality contest?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So a lot of that has pervaded our political system in general in that, and I'll plead guilty to this too, because there are times when I've been like, oh God, Mueller, please just money laundering the whole shebang, just get it all out there, just hoping for a savior. But
yeah,
has become a culture that hopes for a savior, right?
Yeah, I dig what you're saying.
And especially so in these times, given that the individual we're hoping to be saved from has so much power concentrated in upon that one particular office.
Yeah.
Strictly now, taking that into account, that's part of my culture, right? My American culture. Taking that into account, strictly speaking, the Constitution does say that it's up to the Congress to impeach a president, to find them guilty of crimes, or maybe not even crimes, actually. It doesn't even say high crimes and misdemeanors.
High crimes and misdemeanors. It's
a misdemeanor crossing. Jaywalking is a misdemeanor, you know?
Yeah.
But you're not going to impeach a guy on jaywalking. But there's a pretty strong argument, in my opinion, that the framers intended such integrity upon the office of the presidency that they did include that phrase misdemeanors, knowing that they wouldn't impeach somebody for jaywalking, but they wanted to blanket something that may not have been a high crime.
I mean, I've always had the hope that, this is not based in truth. I feel like that opens it up for, they can just say conduct unbecoming. At a certain point, they can say conduct unbecoming. But then over the last couple of years, conduct unbecoming is just like, that's not even an issue anymore.
But here's the thing. I think you're right, though. I do think you're right. I think that the now, don't get me wrong. I think it's a little narrow. Like, I think that the framers would have intended. It kind of goes like this. We elected the guy, right? I mean, we did, whether we did it by majority or not. The system that we're in elected the guy with our votes, okay? And it's debatable on whether or not that's a legitimate system, and maybe you and I can talk about the Electoral College system in another episode.
Uh-huh. But yeah, I see what you're saying, though.
Adults still here, right? And I believe in my heart that the framers designed a system that it's such a big deal to elect a leader that it should be up to the same people who elected that leader to, I guess, maybe for lack of a better term, unelect said leader. Impeach, right?
Yeah.
Take out of office. And I think that when you hear, like, you can go back to when Pelosi just recently said impeachment's not on the table. Well, she's speaking for the people. I mean, the majority of Americans voted them into office. She has an elected elections of consequences, and she has an elected ability to be able to say that because they didn't campaign on impeaching the president. Some of them did, but that wasn't their primary message.
Okay.
So that can change, though, because this report is going to become public, and there probably is unsavory behavior in there that falls under high crimes and misdemeanors. The primary concern for me with impeachment now is that, is there even enough time?
Right. Although there is the argument, and I think we've talked about this before, the argument that even if you don't successfully remove someone from office, it can be worth opening up impeachment proceedings in some circumstances just in order to bring stuff to light.
Oh, so we're going to be talking about that later.
Okay.
I got that on my mind, too, because you're right. You're right. And we're going to be talking about that. That is okay. Our final act of the show.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Okay. So now that matters. Like, really, I've always felt like that it was okay that Mueller didn't make a decision on obstruction of justice, because it's entirely possible, given that he's a Republican, he falls into the line of thinking that some people had at the end of the Watergate scandal, which led to the unitary executive theory. Not that I'm saying I don't know Mueller's political philosophies. I don't know if that's his theory, but this kind of thinking led to the unitary executive theory, which was that it was an overreach of the Department of Justice to come to those conclusions around a president, because the Constitution states that it's the Congress's responsibility to come to those conclusions. Fair?
So he could so can I tell you what I understood it to be before, and tell me where I was wrong?
Shoot.
That it wasn't so much that he would say, here's the deal, this is what you charge him with, but that he could say, here's what I suggest.
Well, that's what Department of Justice usually does. Like if an attorney in the Department of Justice does a study about a particular case, they make a recommendation to their superior or whoever, I think it's to their superior, that, I recommend we prosecute this person. I've got enough evidence to do so. It seems as though they did it. Let's go ahead and go forward with the case. But he was a special counsel, not a special prosecutor.
Okay.
The reason they changed the language after the Clinton debacle, like that was a special prosecutor, but after Clinton, they changed it to a special counsel.
Okay.
So really what his, this is my opinion, that his purvey was to investigate this and to present findings and really not come to a conclusion as far as the president went. The only hole I have in that theory is that they indicted people along the way. So, you know, I'm not real sure that might.
Yeah, you know. I'm troubled by that, though, anyway, because if at the outset it's known that he's not going to make a recommendation, right, of any kind,
right,
then should that have been made public before the 2 years of waiting?
I would think so. That would have been responsible governance.
I don't know. It's tricky.
Well, the other part of the investigation that I think that actually I find this kind of encouraging, and I know this is going to sound kind of backwards, but America was one of the first nations in the world to presume innocence before the court rather than guilt before the court. America, they say you have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Previously in court systems, the defendant was assumed guilty and had to prove their own innocence to the court. And America was the first nation to turn that on its head.
Was it?
Did you not hear? Did it not come through?
No, I heard you. I was just surprised to hear that. Was it really?
Yeah, I believe so. I seem to remember reading that when I was a kid, man. I mean, it was a long time ago.
I don't feel that that's... Oh, well, you know what? We don't Google on this show. I don't know for sure. That's,
yeah. I feel like that's true. I hate to say that though. So now, we'll have to give out a caveat that I may absolutely be wrong about that. I know that, one of the things that we treasure here, maybe would be a better way of putting that, is that we presume innocence before guilt.
Right.
And we really should, as responsible citizens, presume innocence before guilt. We haven't seen anything public from this report, so we should wait for it to. We should wait for the findings before we make our decisions, like responsible humans are supposed to do.
I dig what you're saying. I do.
And I just feel like that's the way we should be acting about it. It's easy, but you know, our culture, we want a savior. So I feel generally good about the report. I think that when it becomes public, that there will be things that are distressing enough to be at the very least used for 2020.
I guess if I can just voice my frustration and if you can like talk me down from this particular ledge of frustration, don't worry, it's only like 3 feet high as ledges go. In movies, there's the character who saw the murder, and then they are at the trial, and then at the end of the trial, the killer gets off, and they're like, but I saw him do it. And I think that's how millions and millions and millions of people feel about it. And I accept your point that maybe a conclusion has not yet been made, but about the question of, say, obstruction of justice. We're like, no, we saw him. He said it. Like, that's not in doubt. You know,
I get that.
The legal system then, you know, I saw the murder, but then the legal system, I understand the legal system had to go and, you know, go through the motions, and then they had to, you know, they had to consult us, and they had to consult all sorts of other things. And then they came up with an answer and they said, okay, he's guilty or he's not guilty, but I saw him do it. And I think that's part of the frustration, that it's not really like some, oh, I wonder if there's something he could find. It's like, well, he could find the same thing we've all seen.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. I see where you're coming from in that, and I do. But you have to think of the Mueller report as from strictly political viewing of the Mueller report, if you're a Democrat, the Mueller report becoming public and presenting like in a what they would call like a nonpartisan way, like if you're ex Democrat on X panel and you start busting out these things that have just been recorded on TV that everybody's already seen, people have already made their judgments about what they've seen on television about what what Trump has said, or what they've seen in his tweets about what Trump has said. People want to know what a supposed middleman arbiter might say about it. And there might be more evidence as to intent from testimony of people who were around Trump when some of these decisions were made. So if you're a Democrat, you're looking at the Mueller report as a political relief valve to the pressure that's on you to find nonpartisan evidence of obstruction of justice or some sort of conspiracy with Russia.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Like if you look at the way the Democrats are now, they're exceedingly frustrated at the way Barr is behaving, and he's really playing them well, that he's just kind of dragging it out and letting the narrative happen before the report comes out, so that hopefully it can mitigate any damage that might come out in the report.
Yeah.
Because clearly there's damaging things in it, or Trump would still be freaking railing about it.
Yeah.
That's an assumption on my part.
Yeah.
Those are my thoughts on the Mueller report.
Okay. Well, that's a really, really good final point.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Republican Party and just the complete and total continuation of the collapse of who they are as an entity.
Okay.
I had like a light bulb moment the other day that they've become completely situational in their politics, not even transactional, situational. Like in a transaction, you would expect to get some sort of equal value for your efforts or your services or your payment. And I don't even see the Republicans getting equal value out of their politics anymore. And I say that in a politicians always want to get reelected kind of way.
Uh-huh.
And it's almost best illustrated by Trump himself, in that he has not tried in any way, shape or form to broaden his appeal amongst the voters of the nation. Do you remember when you and I did the Nixon Watergate parallels for what was going on with Trump?
Yes. Yeah.
And we talked about how Nixon had won re-election with like a huge, huge, like 40 states or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that he had like a 75% approval rating. Well, that's because when he won his first term, he won it like 51%. And he spent 4 years appealing to a broad swath of America to ensure himself re-election.
Okay. That's pretty opposite.
Right. Right. It's exactly the opposite of what Trump's been doing.
Yeah.
And there comes a point where transactional is not transactional anymore if you're not at least receiving an equal share of gain of voting populace from your policies and political statements. That's why I say they're just situational now.
Yeah.
Because they've really become a party who will just say or do anything to come out on top of a political argument of a given moment. It's like they don't think to the future anymore with their political arguments.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by that. Because I wonder, is it just that they're so sure that the attention span has shrunk that much? Because you can, we talked about this before, and you were talking about it, about how you can manage sort of fairly short cycles of information, 2 year cycles.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think some of it is the media culture, some of it, but if it was mostly the media culture, then the Democrats would be doing the same thing, and they don't. I think that maybe the reason the Republicans are in that situation is because they're starting to figure out that their policy ideas are deeply unpopular.
Yeah.
And we can use the health care that Trump just talked about. They're going to be the party of health care or whatever, right? He just said that like last week, you know, And everybody
so
knows that.
So weird.
Well, everybody knows that's not true. I mean, they've been saying nothing but no to any kind of change in a healthcare law for, well, since 2010.
Except trying to strip back what there is.
Right, right, exactly. No to any changes. And we want you to go back to where it was even worse than it is now.
Yeah.
So they have to become – Mitch McConnell said, we're not going to do that. There's only two reasons Mitch McConnell would say that. Because A, he knows his party doesn't have any ideas. And B, he knows that if they do, they are deeply unpopular. And he would not run for re-election on them.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So if you know that you don't really have anything to run a re-election on except for the other side or socialists, then really all you can be is situational in your political arguments. Just day by day, fight this day's news cycle, which is another very Trumpian thing.
Yeah.
Now, whether that's a that feels to me like a chicken and the egg kind of argument, though. Like, if they had that first, or if Trump came along and gave it to him, I would tend to believe they had it first, stemming back to Newt, of course, always Newt, you know?
And there's so many times, yeah. There is so many times, isn't there, when you're looking at something in Trump and you're like, is he the product of this?
Or, right.
Yeah.
I do believe, though, he's a symptom. He's just a symptom of a party that's on the verge of political collapse that is starting to finally figure it out, I think. I think they're finally starting to figure it out. That if they don't grab some semblance of a cohesive political argument towards policy outcomes that are good for the American people on the whole, that they're doomed. I think they're starting to figure it out. I think. There are a couple other things that lead me to believe that to be true as well. They did get 12 senators to vote against Trump's national emergency. That's a big deal.
Yeah. It's
a big deal.
Yeah.
It's not enough to turn over a veto, but it's a big deal. 12 senators have not broken ranks with Trump, but one other time. And I think that one other time might be the most important, which was when both chambers voted overwhelmingly to stop military support of the war in Yemen.
Yeah.
There's been a release of war powers from the from the Article 1 branch to the Article 2 branch over the last, probably since Vietnam, that has been distressing. And the Congress has not acted on the War Powers Act of 1978 since like 1978. So that was a really big deal.
That's interesting. Looking at it through a wider lens, that's interesting. Like taking a longer view.
It is. It's real important. You remember we talked in the last episode about how when the framers wrote the Constitution, they tried to take more than one human lifespan into account.
Yeah.
And this is one of those things, I think. Like, Reagan ran amok against the War Powers Act, just ran amok. The whole Iran-Contra scandal was about him violating the War Powers Act, right? And they even passed legislation during his administration to try to rein him in past what the War Powers Act said, and he ignored it. And then Clinton did the same thing. Clinton sent troops into Bosnia and kept bombing raids over Iraq after HW's administration. Just all kinds of extra military engagements that are covered under the War Powers Act that Congress basically chose to do nothing about. I don't even have to go into the Bush W administration and how the authorization for the UAMF, the authorization for military force, destroyed the War Powers Act, in my opinion. Are you familiar with this act?
No. Well, no. Go on.
It was a post 9/11, one of the big three bad laws passed after 9/11,
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. But go on, please. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. And it was it gave the administration of the United States of America to engage in warlike activity, warring activities anywhere it deemed the national security was at risk because of terrorism.
Okay.
Without having to explain to Congress why it was doing it. So it enabled Obama to roll the drone program over to the CIA, which is expressly against things like the War Powers Act, and that the CIA is not allowed to carry out assassinations.
Now, which is laughable to anybody.
Well, after the Phoenix Project in Vietnam, it really did become a big deal. Like, Congress paid a lot of attention to what the CIA was doing after the Phoenix Project, and that lasted a long time. And they really did try hard to make sure the CIA was not openly assassinating people, I guess might be a better way of putting that. How about that?
I'm sorry. It's funny.
Well, you know.
It's like the best we can shoot for.
That is not an American issue. That is an issue of states since there's been intelligence agencies. You know, what was his name? The Englishman? I can never remember his name. He's a guy that invented modern intelligence agencies back in for one of the queens.
Francis Drake.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, it's an issue of states as long as there's been states.
Right.
Like, exactly, on some level. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But when Obama rolled the drone program over to the CIA, that really pretty much just broke that right. I mean, like, if you're flying, there's really no difference between walking by behind somebody and stabbing them in the back than there is in sending a couple Hellfire missiles down on their head.
Yeah.
Well, there is a difference, actually, in that innocent people get hurt when you do the Hellfire missiles.
Yeah.
So there is a difference, and it's worse. So it's a big deal that Congress is trying to grab its war powers back. I'm really pleased by that. I hope that it continues. It was enormously bipartisan, as well it should be. You can't have one guy deciding whether we go to war or not. That's against the Constitution.
Yeah, and that is heartening.
Yeah, it is heartening. Yeah, it is. And the Republican Party, generally speaking, has always been a war. They've been ready to vote for wars, generally.
Yeah.
For quite some time.
Yeah.
So that's heartening that their party is maybe reconfiguring how they feel about war. The question now for the Republicans is this. As Trump doubles down on immigration and they double down on socialism, can a two-pronged message work? And is the president louder than the people in the districts and the states that are of the Republican Party that will be screaming socialism this election cycle? Which is the louder message? Right. Because, and a lot of that depends too, like, on what bubble you're in, though. Like, we bubble ourselves naturally. I mean, we're social beings. We want to be around like-minded individuals. So, right. Yeah. So depending on what bubble you're in is what message will come out, I think. I tend to believe that Trump is louder than congressional Republicans, personally. I tend to think that's not just Trump, too, but the bully pulpit.
Yeah. That makes sense to me.
Like we talked about, like the difference between a House person and a Senate person on what might move a market or a business decision. Like a senator saying something has more weight than a House person saying something.
Yeah.
Also, as part of the current state of the Republican Party, I wanted to get into just a tiny bit of detail about the emergency declaration, because if you've noticed, and it's only been a couple of weeks, but given the way this guy works, usually things happen pretty quick. And this guy, I mean, Trump, like, I would expect to have heard something by now.
Yeah.
They haven't moved any money.
None. Right.
I can logically attribute that to members of Congress, Republican members, obviously, because there's no bipartisan talk to that White House. I can largely attribute to that to Republican members of Congress who might have, whose districts might suffer because of the moving of money.
Right.
For varying reasons. So
okay, that makes sense.
If it continues to be that there's no action on the moving of money in this emergency declaration, to me, that's a sign of more Republican dysfunction more than White House dysfunction. Because, you know, nothing happens in politics without a reason. Again, nothing doesn't happen in politics without a reason either, if you look at it the other side.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are my thoughts on the Republican Party. What do you think?
I it's such a weird comfort. I mean, you know, that terrible cliche, may you live in interesting times. It's such a weird comfort that it is fascinating to see how it's going to turn out.
It's cold. For the Republicans?
It's cold comfort. Yeah. Yeah. In this particular instance, yes, for them. Like, it is, as awful as they are, a part of me is sort of fascinated to see what they'll do next. In all that, you know? I feel guilty almost saying that, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've been reading The Bulwark lately. I'm not here to really promote any particular websites or whatever. But it is basically, I would say, maybe the newest Never Trumper kind of thing. Although I've seen pieces in there that are beyond Never Trump, and it's a little encouraging. When I hear Republicans start openly talking about how their ideas no longer appeal to the American public, then I'll start believing that they're ready for change.
Yeah. Okay.
I just don't feel like. It's funny. There was a piece actually in the Bulwark this morning that I read before I got to doing all the things I had to do today. Uh-huh. And it was like a fake confessional from Kirstjen Nielsen.
Okay.
And one of the first thing, it was like there was a one line paragraph and then there was an actual paragraph. And it said, I've accepted full responsibility for my actions as politicians speak, for I accept nothing. This is someone else's fault, but we're just going to move past it because I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And there is some truth to that. I don't know that that's always true because, I mean, you can't put yourself in someone else's head, but there is some truth to that. There are politicians who say those things and do those things. But I think that if the Republican Party starts to actually accept the fact that its ideas are deeply unpopular, it probably will have better luck, which I think is actually a good segue to our 2020, if you're cool with that.
Yes.
Okay. And I'll just start with that because that was actually one of the subjects about 2020 that strikes me as something that's becoming more and more relevant for the Republican Party by 2-year election cycle, is that nobody wants to hear tax cuts for the rich anymore. And nobody wants to hear the word job creator anymore. People want to hear you're making more money.
Yeah.
Well, there are plenty of people there are plenty of people that want to hear you're going to make more money. I guess that was a simplistic way of putting it. But people do want to hear the roads are going to be better. People vote negatively easily, but they vote positively passionately. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, actually. It's a nice phrase, too.
So if you take a guy like Buttigieg, have you been paying attention to Mayor Pete lately?
You know, he's one of the only yes, a little bit. I've been taking a break, but
that's right. You did take a break. Yeah. I'll give a real, real brief rejoinder.
But later. I paid it, yeah, a little bit because that guy is amazing. But go on.
He seems to be. He seems very genuine. I like what the words that have come out of his mouth that I've heard so far. I really am not. We're not about. I personally am not about promoting a particular candidate until we're a little further along into the the process. There's like 20 people. I think Swalwell announced yesterday or the day before yesterday. So I'm not trying to say that, you know, Mayor Pete is the candidate or whatever, but no. I heard something really, really, really smart yesterday on, I don't remember what show it was, but it was very smart. No, it was this morning, actually. Heidi Prisbilla, who is an NBC political correspondent, was talking about how the thing that resonated with her about Mayor Pete is that he was using faith as a moral argument to vote for Democrats.
Wow.
And he was saying things like, and he was speaking directly to Mike Pence because Mike Pence was his governor. And he ran for reelection in a year that Mike Pence was doing the, it was the year we had our quote religious freedom end quote bill. Yeah. And he said something that struck me. He said, why I'm gay is above my pay grade, and it's above your pay grade too, Mike Pence. And as a Christian, you should know that. He didn't say those words exactly, but that's what he was saying.
Yeah.
Who are you to second guess what God has in store for me?
Yeah.
And as a strident Democrat, he's making the argument that I'm the moral one here. You're not.
Which I think he's, yeah, I've been impressed with his oratory. I really have. That speech that he made about how he says our friends across the aisle, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, the old school
or our conservative friends, which he's really he has a nice way of going about it. But his speech about what freedom actually means and how actually maybe members of the Democratic Party do have a right to talk about freedom and do have a right to say, no, we are the party of freedom. I thought that was a really interesting speech. It was everybody saw that, huh? That one was going around.
Yeah.
But I was pretty struck by that, actually. I thought it was a pretty effective piece of oratory.
It's a way to take the narrative back. It's a way to take the flag back. It's a way to take the patriotism back that the right stole from the Democratic Party after 9/11.
Right.
There was a time in America when patriotism meant openness and freedom, and now there's a time in America where patriotism means closeness and oppression.
Yeah.
Because the party that believes in closeness and oppression co-opted that term. And candidates like Mayor Pete have an opportunity to take that term back.
Yeah.
Fair?
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. Like, there are exciting things happening, as disillusioning as some recent events have been. And I think I do think you're right, by the way. We haven't seen an end to this question yet. But aside from that, it is exciting. There's so much potential right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And generally speaking, the messages to me, it seems generally should – the ones that have the hopeful messages is the one that are going to win, because every single time we elect a president, the opposite of the last one.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah.
And if that's what happens, it's going to be someone hopeful and inclusive who is ready to take back the narrative of patriotism.
Yeah.
That's what I feel about the Democratic side. As far as the candidates go, now, there's a whole other aspect of campaigning that is congressional activities during campaign seasons, right?
Right.
Really best illustrated by Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi.
Yeah.
That would be a really excellent illustration of how congressional activity can affect an election.
Yeah.
Because there would have been no investigation into Hillary's emails if there wasn't Trey Gowdy's Benghazi investigation. Tracking me?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, which does go back to the Mueller report, right?
Yeah.
It's the little things that come out that lead to the bigger things when it comes to politics. That's why there'll be leaks. People want to leak the little things. And you can take that to 2020 in that the perfect time to leak little damaging things that lead to larger things is at the beginning or in the heat of an election season.
Yeah.
Would the Democrats rather campaign on just work? I mean, for example, just we're going to keep healthcare, or would they rather campaign on we're going to keep healthcare and, oh, by the way, this administration has done this, 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 and this while they were in power that has been abuse of your tax dollars? Right?
Yeah.
So you have Congress engaging in electioneering. Now, please understand that I am not saying that this is ideally the way my government should work, but that's the way it is working.
Okay.
Fair?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have Congress who would be engaging in electioneering, not only for themselves, but for the broader democratic movement by their political and oversight investigations that they may be having during the election season.
Yeah.
Now, these investigations, though, unlike Benghazi, are legitimate. So it's not quite as bad to me that they would be doing it. I mean, bad, like ethically bad or morally bad or even like kind of underhanded. To me, it doesn't really fall under that same category because there's definitely malfeasance in this administration that needs to be exposed.
To put it one way, you could say if doing the right thing is advantageous to you, that does not make it the wrong thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And the administration has done this to themselves. It's not like they're digging for things that don't exist.
Right.
So if you have an administration that is engaging in corrupt behaviors, then it's the Congress's responsibility to investigate it. And if it comes out during an election and they're doing the right thing by investigating it, so be it. That's, you should have thought of that before you did it, administration.
Yeah.
If you wanted re-election, you should have thought about that. That's the correct functioning of our system. So you'll hear Republicans, oh, this is all politically motivated. You're going to hear it too. This is all politically motivated. They just want to attack the president. They don't like the president. Yeah, that might be true. It might very well be true. But the other half of that story is it's a legitimate oversight function, and the administration should have thought about re-election before they engaged in the activities that were exposed in the legitimate oversight functions. Correct? Yeah. So that's the system working. That's a really hopeful thing. It'll be dirty. It'll be ugly. Sometimes systems working are.
Yeah.
So that's what I think about like congressional behavior for 2020. Now, when you look at 2020 from like a strictly numbers point of view, as most, you know, paid electioneers do, Trump is in a whole lot of trouble whether his approval rating stays at 45% or 42% or 38%. He's in a whole lot of trouble. First off, you can't get elected on 45% support. You just can't. You can't. He had more than that when he didn't get, you know, the popular vote. He had 48% support. You can't get elected on 45% support. And more distressing for Trump is that in the states where he won the small amount of votes he needed to grab the electoral college votes, he's becoming more underwater by the day because his policies suck.
Right.
Well, I'll give you a great example of it, actually. And this is not just in this state, but I read a nice piece the other day about how Joni Ernst is having a heck of a time running for re-election in Iowa right now because people keep asking her, what is that guy doing and why are you not fighting it? I can't sell my soybeans. I can't sell my pigs. I can't sell my cattle. What is this guy doing? And whether they get checked from the government or not, they're still sitting on a bunch of soy they got to find a way to get rid of and a bunch of pigs they got to find a way to get rid of, you know?
Yeah.
And so what you have is these states where they some of those states, I think, voted in what I like to call the fuck you vote, which was like not a fuck you to liberals per se, as it was more of like a screw you government. You're not doing me right. So I'm going to send it as a disruptor up there.
Yeah.
Whether that was misguided or not, to me, misguided. But hey, you know, you vote how you want to vote, I guess.
It was a vote like the kindest thing you could say about it might be that it was a vote against the status quo.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying. In the kindest way I could put it, it was a screw you vote that's not working. You know, and
yeah.
I think that there are plenty of people in the nation, and I have talked to some people around here who feel that way, that they felt like their vote was to try to disrupt the system, to maybe send a message that we want change, when the change that they are getting is not the change that they wanted.
No shit. Yeah.
And I would say that probably some of those voters would be falling under the more low information voter range in that, yeah, well, that guy seems okay, and I don't like Hillary, but I don't really know much about politics, but that guy seems okay, and I don't like Hillary, so I'm going to vote for that guy.
Yeah.
Now, how anyone could think, could be so out of touch with the media reality, with the media of our nation, that they wouldn't know the heinous things that he did along the way. I mean, I don't know. That's beyond me.
Yeah, but it happened.
But it happened. And yeah. I'm sure there are plenty of people who voted for Trump that didn't know that he said McCain was a war hero or whatever, right? I mean, maybe not so much anymore. That's the thing. It's like his ratings are underwater because those things eventually do come to light. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who are like, he said that? Man, I voted for that guy. What the hell? Right? Mm-hmm. That's the only reason I can figure he's underwater is because he's affecting the actual livelihood of some of the people who sent him there to maybe improve their own fortunes.
Yes, that is a generous and compassionate analysis, and I accept it.
Connor, I try not to be judgmental as much as I can. I let somebody explain themselves before I make a judge on what they're doing, you know? But that's my thoughts on the 2020. I mean, it's in no way a lock. I don't think it's a lock. There's entirely possible that the Democrats are really good at running bad candidates. So it's entirely possible that they'll pick the worst candidate. I'll be voting Democrat, so I should include myself. But it's entirely possible that the party may come up with the worst candidate and get beat anyway. Man, I hope not. The system is pretty strained. But I feel like the behaviors of this current president just make his fortunes worse and worse by the day. Again, he's not expanding his voting base. He's shrinking it. And, you know, I mean, I live in a nation where 1-2% shrinkage of your voting base is enough to keep you from office.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just the truth of it. If you lose 2%, when these electioneers do their numbers, they look at districts, and you need, like, let's say there's a suburb, let's say maybe the Tennessee suburbs of Nashville, they might vote Republican generally because of one reason or another. And if you know exactly how many districts you need to win in that particular region of districts to keep the district count high enough for you to win the state, you've really, you know, piecemealed people out pretty detailed wise. So really it only takes 1-2% drop in support, you know, 100,000 votes here, 5,000 votes in a smaller district, suddenly you're losing big.
Yeah.
It's like Fox News talks about how they're the most popular network in the country, cable network in the country. Their viewership is less than 3% of the country.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
that's interesting. You
know, they get like 18 million people a night. I have 300 million people in this country, man. Like, is that really a threat to democracy?
You know, it's so funny because it had never occurred to me to think about that before. Like, young people don't really watch TV.
No, they don't.
And certainly not in a live broadcast television, watching it while it's on kind of way.
Right.
That's really, that's funny. I never thought about it that way.
So when... But that's a power. But if you look at the other side of it, you know, to take the analogy, those 3% have a voice. It's a strong voice that is affecting the narrative of the nation. Yeah. So if Trump loses 3% of the nation, I mean, that's, you know, 20 million people, man, or whatever, yeah. Right? Whatever that quick math is.
Yeah.
Well, that only has to be in select spots before suddenly, you know, he's losing 45 states. I wouldn't go that high. We're pretty bifurcated right now, but I wouldn't see it out of pocket that he just gets destroyed in the Electoral College. I wouldn't see that outside of the bounds of possibility.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's pretty much how I feel about 2020. Like, that's the current state of our affairs, I think, right now. It's still precarious. It's a little bit hopeful, but I think the future is still pretty bright, generally speaking.
Okay.
It just takes time and patience.
Yeah. Are you telling me that I have to be a grown-up?
Grown-upping is the hardest thing I've ever done.
I don't want to. All right. Well, folks, help us to be grown-ups. I've been taking a little bit of a Twitter break, but if you say hello, I will still greatly appreciate it. And thank you very much. Thank you so much for listening. And, you know, even while I haven't been around that much, I've seen some lovely things that people have been saying. And it means a lot, actually. It means a lot to us. I'm sure that's true for both of us.
You guys mean the world to us. Thank you for your time every single time.
Yeah. Yeah, we really appreciate it. So okay. Reach out and tell us what you think. And
for sure.
We always want to hear it. And, you know, we've talked about this before. We have like a whole board full of future episodes, things that Fan and I have talked about and been like, oh, that's an episode. We got to do that, you know. But there's space on the board. So there might be something that you'd like to hear about. We can't guarantee that we would turn that into a whole episode, but we might. So reach out if that's the case.
All right. Well, good night, everybody.
Good night, folks.